From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, poet and singer Patti Smith recalls her friendship with the late photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. They lived together during the years they were creating their artistic identities. She was one of his first models, and he encouraged her to sing. Smith has a forthcoming book of prose poems inspired by Mapplethorpe, written after his death. There's also a new book of his work. Also, we talk with David Russell, the screenwriter and director of the new comedy Flirting with Disaster. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Last Orders, a new novel by Graham Swift. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Clinton met today with Lebanon's President Elias Houari today in the White House during a photo session. The president said he'd received some encouraging news about a possible ceasefire between Israeli forces and Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon, but he did not elaborate. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is continuing his shuttle diplomacy in the region. NPR's Eric Weiner says U.S. officials are cautious in the way they describe their progress.
They are not using the word progress or anything like it. They say the talks have reached a new intense stage, and Secretary Christopher has said he will stay in the region as long as it is useful. He would not say that he would stay in the region until a ceasefire is reached, but clearly that is his goal. But there are still great differences between the Syrians and the Lebanese on one side and the Israelis on the other.
NPR's Eric Weiner in Jerusalem. House Speaker Newt Gingrich today announced the creation of a special investigative panel to examine the U.S. role in the Iranian arms shipments to Bosnia. The move comes a day after a senior State Department official said the Clinton administration tacitly approved a 1994 arms transfer because Bosnia's desperate military situation. Gingrich said the selection of the subcommittee, when the House International Relations Committee will include 5 Republicans and 3 Democrats, the panel will be chaired by Illinois Republican Henry Hyde. The UN War Crimes Tribunal today ordered the humanitarian release of a Bosnian Serb general who is dying of cancer, but the panel refused to drop the charges. Gillian Sharp reports from The Hague.
General Jordi Djukic was too ill to be in court to hear the order for his release. An independent doctor has confirmed that he has cancer and has only days or weeks to live. The prosecution wanted the indictment against him dropped, with an option to re-indict at a later stage. The defense opposed dismissal on health grounds, saying the charges should be dropped through lack of evidence. In the end, the judge granted neither request, but provisionally released General Djukic. He's now free to join his family in Belgrade, but must keep the tribunal informed of his movements and return to The Hague if his health improves. His son, Alexander, told reporters that the fight to clear his father's name would continue. For National Public Radio, I'm Gillian Sharp in The Hague.
Trial began today for the man accused of masterminding the nerve gas attack on a Tokyo subway. Security was tight as Shoko Ashara entered the courthouse. Ashara refused to enter a plea or confirm his real identity. If convicted, he faces death by hanging, but the process could take years. To underscore the enormity of the crime, the court spent 6 hours reading the names of the victims. The Commerce Department said today durable goods orders rose 1.4% last month. Orders for new aircraft gave the economy much of its lift. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 36 points at 5551.74. Volume is 228 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Theodore Kaczynski is continuing his attempt to block charges from being filed that connect him with any of the Unabomber's crimes. Kaczynski is appealing last week's federal judge's ruling, which said fair grand jury hearings are still possible despite leaks in the case. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Theodore Kaczynski's attorneys want the appeals court to consider a motion they unsuccessfully argued before a federal judge in Montana last week. The court-appointed attorneys want to block grand jury consideration of Kaczynski's case. They want no further prosecution of him. And they want the government to return to Kaczynski the hundreds of items seized from his mountain cabin, including presumably the explosives agents found. They say leaks about the cabin search mean Kaczynski can't get a fair grand jury hearing. The Montana judge rejected the motion. The appeal keeps it alive for now. Kaczynski remains jailed in Helena, Montana. The Unabomber last struck 1 year ago today when timber industry lobbyist Gilbert Murray died in an explosion in Sacramento. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
A House subcommittee today opened hearings on fees charged by banks to ATM customers. In an opening statement, House Banking Committee Chairman Jim Leach said the recent fee hikes could erode consumers' confidence in the banking industry and suggested the industry impose some self-restraint. Democrat Charles Schumer has introduced legislation requiring banks to clearly disclose such fees to consumers, a practice ATM network operators say already exists. Lurking on the fringes of the ATM fee debate is the fact that the banking industry recorded $48 billion in profits last year. NATO defense experts have agreed on final details of a plan to allow European countries to have more say in defense and security issues on their continent. Agreement on the proposal is seen as an essential element to a broader reform of NATO's command structure. Under the revamped military structure, NATO would be allowed to undertake peacekeeping missions. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe were both 20-year-old aspiring artists when they met in 1967. They soon moved in together and profoundly influenced each other's artistic development. Smith went on to become one of the most influential rock stars of her generation, and Mapplethorpe became one of the most controversial artists of his. His photographs of nudes, often in erotic and sadomasochistic poses, put him right in the center of the battle over censorship and federal funding of the arts. Mapplethorpe died of AIDS in 1989 at the age of 42. Recently, Random House published a book of his work called Altars. Patti Smith has a book of short prose poems dedicated to and inspired by Mapplethorpe called The Coral Sea. It will be published at the end of May by Norton. Although Smith is reluctant to talk much about herself and her music, she was happy to talk with us about Mapplethorpe, his work, and their long friendship. She thinks many people know Mapplethorpe only through the controversy and misinterpret his work.
Robert considered himself an artist, and he was in no way a homosexual artist or a, well, he didn't have boundaries like that. I think it's incorrect to label him that way. In his body of work, he regarded a body part, a flower, a rooster, a statue with the same aesthetic principles.
He took a bunch of photographs of you. What was it like to be photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe?
Well, I was his first model, so when we were younger, he followed me around continuously with a cheap Polaroid camera, and I got to a point where I'd start hiding because I didn't want to be photographed anymore. But I always actually enjoyed being photographed by Robert. It was always quick, simple, very little direction, very natural. Until the end of his life, we always did our work together very quickly in natural light. And being photographed by Robert, not just from myself, but other models have said the same thing. There exists between him and his model trust. And I always felt working with Robert, the trust of our friendship. We trusted each other as people. We cared about each other as people, and so when we worked together, we extended that same care into our work. I wanted his work to be good. He wanted to present me in the best light, so that's what I mostly think about, is that element of trust.
He took the photograph, perhaps the most famous photograph of you that was on your the cover of your album, Horses, I think in 1975. In which you're wearing a kind of oversized white shirt and an undone tie with a suit jacket slung over your shoulder. Tell us how that photograph came about.
Well, we wanted to take the cover, and Robert knew where he wanted to take it. It was up in Sam Wagstaff's apartment in New York City, which was a very white room, and there was a triangle of light that used to come through a window, and he was extremely interested in photographing that triangle. And we went up there, and I remember the light started changing, and he wanted us to hurry up, and we had to run. We couldn't get a cab, and we had to run as fast as we could because he could really feel the light changing. And in terms of my clothing, it was just my usual clothes. I used to like, I really wanted to have a Baudelairean type of look. I wanted a black and white sort of a mixture of just how I was and a little 19th century feel in it. But in the end, the final photograph, which some people have made quite a bit of, the particular pose or stance in the photograph, was really a tribute to Frank Sinatra.
The Capitol years.
Well, no, actually, he did a movie. I think it was called, I don't think it was Pal Joey. It was the Joey Lewis story. And Joey Lewis was a singer that got in trouble with the mob and got his throat cut, and he wound up a comedian. I don't know if you remember that, but
yeah, it's the movie that All the Way comes from.
Yeah, that's right. The last scene of it, Frank Sinatra's walking alone down a dark street with a lantern. There's a lantern lit street, and he sort of philosophically talking to himself in a pane of glass, and he slings his coat over his shoulder and philosophically walks into the city sunset. But I always thought it was cool the way he slung his coat over his shoulder. So there was only a couple of photographs in that particular shooting like that, but that was the one Robert picked, the Frank Sinatra shot.
The Joker is Wild, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. The Joker is Wild. Appropriate title.
You met Robert Mapplethorpe in 1967 when you were 20. Do I have that right?
Yes.
How did you meet?
Well, we met in Brooklyn. I was around Pratt Institute of Art where he went to school. I had a friend there, and my friend had moved, and I was looking for my friend, and I knocked on the door where he used to be, and someone said, well, I don't know where your friend is, but you can ask the guy in there. And I went in another room and saw this kid sleeping on this cot, and I just stood there and was watching him sleep, and he opened his eyes and smiled at me, and that's how we met.
Now, was he already taking photographs when you met?
No, he didn't start taking photographs till late 69 when we were at the Chelsea Hotel. He really only started taking photographs. He was doing drawings, paintings, and collages, and some constructions. And then later he did installations. But in his huge montages and collages, he used a lot of magazine pictures, holy cards, existing pictures, reproductions of Michelangelo, who he greatly admired, reproductions of statues and sculpture. But he was never satisfied, and he really started taking photographs to insert within his other work. He didn't set out to become a photographer. He really just wanted to create his own information for his drawings and montages.
Did you help each other with your work?
Always.
What ways were you able to help him, and how did he help you?
Well, we helped each other in any way we could, whether it be financially or an encouraging word or constructive criticism, and just mutual belief in each other's work. When you, that's something really that no one can duplicate nor take away from you, is when you have another human being that completely believes in your work.
Was he the first person who completely believed in your work?
I'd say so, yes.
You've said that Mapplethorpe helped you make the transition from psychotic to serious art student. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm never quite sure of what I meant. You know, when people ask me to explain what I said 20 years ago or something. It's I couldn't exactly say what I meant, but I probably when I met him, I felt like my work was really an extension of my neuroses, and instead of an extension of intelligence. And by helping me believe in myself as a person and gaining respect for my own intelligence, shifted the emphasis where the work came from. I really did start writing and drawing when I was younger to relieve myself from certain emotional tensions. But
like what?
Well, I mean, whatever tensions people have when they're growing up, whether it be fear or sexual tensions or parental tension, youthful paranoia, I don't know. Name it.
No, I think he gave you the money to record your first record, the 45 that had Hey Joe on one side and Piss Factory on the other. Tell me the story of that.
Well, it's really simply Robert, for a long time I had helped him financially, and Robert's situation got more solid. He had a really benevolent and wonderful patron, Sam Wagstaff. And through Sam Wagstaff, Robert was able to finance our first our only independent single. And that's all the story was. I wanted to do a single and didn't have the money, and he gave it to me. So we went into Electric Ladyland one night and did it in one night.
We may look the same, shoulder to shoulder, sweating 110 degrees, but I will never faint. I will never faint. They laugh and they expect me to faint, but I will never faint. I refuse to lose. I refuse to fall down. Every afternoon like the last one, every afternoon like a rerun, next to Dot Hook, and yeah, we look the same, both pumping steel, both sweating, but you know she got nothing to hide, and I got something to hide here called desire, I got something to hide here called desire, and I will get out of here, you know the fear potion is just about to come, in my nose is the taste of sugar, and I got nothing to hide here save desire, and I'm gonna go, I'm gonna get out of here. Get out of here, I'm gonna get on that train, and I'm gonna go on that train and go to New York City, and I'm gonna be somebody.
Robert always, when we were younger, he always thought that I should sing, although it was never really an ambition of mine. And he was really happy when I wanted to do the single, and he was really pleased to be a part of it.
Had he heard you sing? I mean, would you sing? Were you singing in the house before you were singing in performance?
Yeah, you know, I'd, you know, be making spaghetti or washing clothes and sing. I used to sing little songs, and for some reason he liked my singing. I used to sing little blues songs and things, and he always thought I should sing.
You think you would have done it if he didn't nudge you in that direction?
Well, he did push me towards that, but it was a series of people, actually. You know, Sam Shepard was really instrumental in getting me to sing in public. I had a few different friends that seemed to think that I was I had a bend toward that. And I really do believe if it wasn't for those friends, or Lenny Kaye and a few others, no, I don't believe that I would be singing, at least not recording. I mean, I might still be singing around the house making spaghetti, but I can't say that I would have been recording.
My guest is Patti Smith. Next month, her book of prose poems, inspired by Robert Mapplethorpe, will be published. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Patti Smith, and we're talking about her long friendship with the late photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. There's a new book of his work called Altars. You and Mapplethorpe were both unknown when you met. In other words, you didn't have reputations in...
We were 20 years old.
Exactly, right.
And neither one of us were Arthur Rimbaud. That's
yeah.
You know, actually, Arthur Rimbaud was unknown when he was 20 as well, so I guess it's...
Did you each have a sense of what you hoped to become? I mean, he seemed to have, from what you're saying, a real sense of what he wanted to be. He knew he wanted to be an artist.
We really, both of us had a lot of bravado and did imagine that we were going to make our mark in the world. I mean, considering both of us at 20, we were both fairly awkward misfits who often were the brunt of people's jokes. I'd say we did have a lot of bravado. We believed in ourselves, we believed in each other, we believed in our work, and we really felt that someday we would do something worthwhile.
Now, I think you said it was in 1969 that Mapplethorpe actually started taking pictures and moved away from the collages he was doing to do photography instead. What was the subject matter of the early photographs he did? What type of subject matter?
Pretty much the same as he always did. He photographed statues, sculpture. He photographed me quite a bit. He started branching out and photographed a lot of self-portraits. Most of his early photographs were self-portraits and photographs of myself. And then he branched out and photographed a lot of young men, usually in place of, I would say, sculpture. You know, he really admired sculpture. He had thought of being a sculptor when he was younger, and he really admired Michelangelo, and he liked the human form, and he began to photograph various parts of the body of mostly males. And later he branched out into females.
When did the sadomasochistic subject matter start entering his work?
He photographed that particular body of work, I think, in the early 70s. And it's a very difficult body of work. It's not for everybody. It's highly sophisticated. And it was difficult for him to shoot. But he really felt that strangely privileged in a way to be able to shoot these practices, and he shot them respectfully, and was trying. The things he was attempting at that time were very much like the things Genet was attempting, was to take material. Or to take certain sexual practices or ways of life that were deemed socially unacceptable or pornographic, and to present them in a respectful, if not beautiful, manner, to project them as elegantly as possible. I mean, certainly no one has described, male copulation or the things that men do with men is more beautifully than Genet. And Robert was attempting to do the same type of thing with his work. He wanted to, since people do these things, he tried to photograph them with dignity and grace. So that he wasn't photographing them as social commentary, or as if Diane Arbus would, to show the sad, twisted aspect of mankind. He really photographed them to show a certain amount of beauty and trust in that moment. Because certainly, as much as I can glean about it, sadomas masochistic practices definitely depend on trust. And I think that he felt that was very interesting to him, to watch something so difficult that depended on trust. And they also, at the same, simultaneously, had to trust him that he wasn't going to exploit or interfere with their practices.
As you said, this art isn't for everybody.
No, it's not.
Did you relate to it? Do you relate to it?
No, but I felt some of the work is really too difficult for me to even look at. But I always admired Robert's integrity and high-mindedness in doing that kind of work.
You have two children, so they haven't seen difficult photos, I take it.
No, they can look at them later, but if they wish. But Robert knew I felt like that, and he often, he had a sense of humor, and also he was very, very compassionate about those things. He knew that this work was not for everyone, and certainly when Robert had shows and he felt, if he felt that some of the work was too hard on certain people, he would have been the first to take that work down and put another piece up, because to him it was all the same. And but what he used to do to me is he'd often take his most difficult pictures and he'd put one under my pillow, or I had a big book of Peter Pan stories that I used to love, beautiful book of Peter Pan with these beautiful paintings in it, and I used to like to look at it, and sometimes I wouldn't look at it for a few months, and then I'd one night pick it up and there would be one of those pictures, put in, and he'd hear me go, "Robert," and he'd start laughing because he knew that I had finally found the picture. But it was just a fun between us. Robert was really funny. He had a great sense of humor, and he loved to tease like that.
Patti Smith's book of prose poems, inspired by Robert Mapplethorpe, will be published next month. It's called The Coral Sea. Smith will be back with us to talk more about Mapplethorpe in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Casting Against Type. We talk with David Russell, the screenwriter and director of Flirting with Disaster. Russell convinced Mary Tyler Moore to take her shirt off in the film and cast Alan Alda as a new age con man. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Last Orders, a new novel by Graham Swift. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet, singer, and songwriter Patti Smith. She has a new book of prose poems inspired by and dedicated to the late photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, her longtime friend. Her book, The Coral Sea, will be published next month. How did Robert Mapplethorpe react to the controversy around his work and to attempts to censor it?
He never really understood. He did know that the certain of the sadomasochistic pictures were difficult. He knew they weren't, those particular pictures weren't for everybody, and he usually, whenever he showed them specially. He showed them in glass cases, he showed them in rooms that had a warning sticker, and he believed that's the way it should be. He never really, he felt that intelligent adults and people in the art world who are sophisticated should have been able to comprehend and appreciate his work. But he always realized that a certain aspect of his work was not for everyone, but that was only a certain aspect of his work. He did photographed quite, I think, more flowers and more human beings, more sculpture, more children than he did controversial photos. The controversial photos are really a small percentage of his work. And he died before the really big controversy happened. I think it would have really been painful for him, especially when he was called a child pornographer.
Was it painful for you? You had just lost somebody really close to you. And then he was, you know, the subject of all this controversy in the press.
It was painful for me to see that because I knew that would have just been terrible for him. He was great with children. He loved children. He was not in the remotest way interested in children physically. And all of his pictures were done lovingly, humorously, or aesthetically without any, not the slightest evil thought, and I have a feeling he would have been very happy to remove the photographs that people found so terrible and replace them with other photographs of equal merit, because his belief in his work did not, was not in the subject matter of his work. It was the intuition and the intelligence that he had that gave him the ability to beautifully frame an object, to his sense of composition, his sense of lighting. Robert, for instance, could produce blacks in his the color black in his photographs, a deeper black than anyone I've ever seen. He became in his lifetime really a master at lighting, and he really believed that photography was basically a romance with lighting.
Robert Mapplethorpe took the photograph for an album that you made in 1988 after a long hiatus from recording. Would you describe that album cover for us and your feelings about the photograph? It's a very different image than the one he did for your 1975 album.
The Dream of Life,
yeah.
Album cover. Well, at the time I was about 6 or 7 months pregnant, and I wanted Robert was had been ill, and he was doing most of his work in the studio, but I really wanted, and we did some studio work, but I really wanted to do something like we did when we were younger, in natural light. And he wasn't as keen on it as I was, but we found a little spot. We were in California, actually, and what's behind me, I think, was a huge dying palm tree. And I just sat in front of it, and, I just had my old sweater on, and my hair was braided, and the sun was quite bright, and Robert wasn't feeling well that day, but he took the pictures anyway. And I remember his hand was shaking so much that he dropped his light meter, and he had to do the shooting without the light meter. And so when he got the negatives back, he was disappointed in them because they were thin, he said. So we were going to use a studio picture, and he didn't even show me those pictures. And he knew I wanted another one, but I was going to go with the one he chose. And then he called me up and he said, "All right, I'm going to send you the picture that you want." And because I just couldn't bear arguing with him about the picture. I let him choose the studio picture. And I was really surprised, and the next day the photograph arrived, and it was exactly what I wanted. Not perhaps the most flattering picture or anything, but it was just like myself at the time. And in it, when I looked at it, I could see my whole life in that photograph, and all the trust that was between Robert and I really felt was in that picture. And it was really his last true gift to me, was to give me that photograph, because he felt, he really did it for me. He really didn't feel it was his best work, and he was very unhappy with the lighting and things like that. But he knew enough about me that he knew that would be the picture that I'd like. And that's how we got the cover of Dream of Life, which nobody really liked. I mean, the record company didn't like it, and a lot of people didn't like it, but I liked it. And he gave it to me, and that was the cover.
You've been doing some writing inspired by Robert Mapplethorpe, and you have a forthcoming book called The Coral Sea. Maybe you could read us a piece from there and tell us a little bit about the evolution of this writing.
Well, The Coral Sea is it's a series of small prose poems that are linked together that I wrote in 1989 when Robert passed away. I really wrote it in lieu of tears because, knowing Robert the way that I do, he would have more appreciated to have a body of work in his name than a bucket of tears. So I wrote The Coral Sea for him. And this is just one of the pieces, and it's called A Bed of Roses. He had come to the conclusion that each of us knows everything. For destiny is our familiar, she permeates our breath. Hers is the atmosphere whereupon a babe pillows his head. Signs wave their arms as we pass over. Lovers avert their eyes until the quivering recognition becomes unbearable, and they part, each holding a piece of future fitting together like a dime store heart. He was destined to be ill, and part of him knew it, but he did not wish to address it, not now. So he fled into the bowels of tedium, disguised as adventure, a liner in the center of the sea, into a mind untapped, pure and roomy. Here time stretched like a superhero of elastic play, a superhero of elastic clay. Here destiny could be courted and swept off her feet. Such a prospect filled him with a tremendous resolve, and he grasped the signs, molding and remolding them. He leaned against the rail, euphoric, drumming scores of tiny thorns into the sea. And there he surrendered, a youth stretched spread-eagle upon a bed of roses, a burning held like a claw within his swelling belly, which he slit with his own hand. Too numb to feel, too ecstatic to speak.
Patti Smith. Her book of prose poems, The Coral Sea, will be published next month. There's a recent book of Mablethorpe's work called Altars. Here's music from Patti Smith's latest album, Dream of Life. Coming up, the director of Flirting with Disaster. This is Fresh Air. My guest David O. Russell wrote and directed the new film comedy Flirting with Disaster. His first film, Spanking the Monkey, was about incest. Flirting with Disaster stars Ben Stiller as a neurotic and conflicted new father who's trying to find out more of his own family history. He's adopted and feels he can't function as a father until he finds his own birth parents. Led by an adoption agency counselor, Stiller, his wife, and their baby cross the country in search of his birth parents. Meanwhile, his adoptive parents, played by Mary Tyler Moore and George Segal, wait at home in New York, anxious, rejected, and insecure. When they finally get a call from Stiller, they imagine the worst.
Are you all right?
We're fine. There was a big mix-up in San Diego, and then I ended up finding a post office with a truck.
What truck?
Truck. What's happening with the truck? We had the wrong information, but we have the right information now. We're going to New Mexico.
New Mexico?
Tell them they got uranium in the water down there.
Shush, she's in some kind of trouble.
Stiller finally meets his birth parents, a couple of former biker hippie drug dealers, played by Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda. In this scene, they're taking Stiller around the house, and Tomlin is showing the pottery she's made.
This is slab construction. If you can see the... And when I roll it out, then I have weeds, and with the rolling pin, I impress them right into the surface.
Just ordinary weeds. You put the weeds in the clay.
And then when you fire it, the weeds burn off. Here,
see, so where the weeds were, you get that.
Stick your fingers in here. No, isn't that sexy?
Yeah, yeah.
No, stick two fingers inside and just caress it. That's it.
There you go.
Uh-huh. Now feel the texture on the out.
Yes.
No, against your face. Against your face.
That texture.
Oh, it's kind of, it's very rough.
Amazing. Oh, yeah.
It looks rough, but it's very smooth.
Right, right.
Smooth.
David, your parents must be so proud. Your previous film was about incest, and your new one is about someone whose adoptive parents drive him so crazy, but his birth parents might even be worse. So, I mean, how do your parents feel about your film career so far?
They have to take what they can get. You know? the first one was an odd combination of pride and mortification, and this one is closer to pride. My sister's adopted, and I think they were a little scared because she went through this process, which inspired me to write it. But I think they see that it takes a sort of a very relativistic view towards parenting.
What did you think about watching your sister go through the process of finding her birth parents?
I saw how mercurial it was, that one minute it was the second coming and the next minute it was terrifying. I think any time you're looking for a holy grail, that's what it's going to be like.
Did she think that she'd find birth parents who would be, kind of ennobling and... give her a completely different identity and take her out of the ordinariness of her life?
I think it's hard to resist a fantasy like that, you know? I mean, I think our culture would cease to function if people felt that they were great the way they were and that they had everything they needed. I mean, who would buy bread, deodorant, or listen to radio shows?
Now, you've made really interesting choices in casting the people who play the birth parents and the adoptive parents in the film. And mostly these are actors who I would think have a hard time finding really good roles now. Mary Tyler Moore, Alan Alda, Lily Tomlin, George Segal.
I think you're soon going to be seeing Mary putting a needle in her arm and shooting someone in the face. Because I think she wants to be able to play against type, and I think this movie shows that she can.
Yes, well, there's one scene which she undoes her shirt, and another scene in which she's in very sexy underwear.
Flossing after she is involved in an oral sex act with George.
There you go. Siegel. Yeah. So, did you have to talk her into doing this?
Not at all. She lobbied. She lobbied heavy for it. She showed up in a tight dress and said, "I don't want to parody Robin Laura Petrie," because I wanted her to play with Dick Van Dyke, the sort of dream parents that Ben finds halfway through the movie, currently played by Alan and Lily. And she said, "I don't want to do that, but I do want to do this." And I said, "Well, I had Madeline Kahn or Anne Bancroft in mind." She said, "No, they've done that a million times. It'll be much more interesting if I do it." And she was right.
Why did you want to cast Alan Alda as the role of in the role of the birth father?
Well, I knew I wanted somebody who would seem super cool and mellow, and he was the 70s poster boy for Ms. Magazine, you know? And he,
right.
he just was Mr. 70s sensitive therapy and intelligent, and then you want to turn him on his head and show that he's criminal and narcissistic and self-absorbed, and that's it's more fun to turn that corner if the guy is Mr. New Age at the beginning.
Was he game?
Yeah, he understood the character right away. He'd worked with some actors in the 70s who had done a lot of LSD and who had actually given up some children to join an ashram, all in the name of enlightenment. And he said what clicked for him was how patronizing they could be as they were describing these things. It's like they always knew more than you did. Oh, if you only understood. Haven't you read this book? Haven't you meditated?
And the birth mother you cast as Lily Tomlin.
Yeah, you know, Lily, I didn't know. I just knew I wanted somebody exciting in that part, somebody who I respected and who was really fun. And it's fun for Lily to play Donna Reed, you know, who she kind of is at the beginning. She has this kind of 50s dress on, and she's, "Oh, we have plenty of room for all of you. Don't you want something to eat?" And then, you know, she too turns out to have more of a sordid past. Lily and Alan are fabulous improvisers. They're the kind of people who, when you cut, other people go get coffee, and they're walking back and forth saying, "Look, what if I did it? What about this? What if I tried it this way?" And 8 out of 10 times you're saying, "Well, I don't think so," but that doesn't dissuade them. You know, they're just obsessively inventive.
Did you think that Alan Alda and Lily Tomlin would be convincing together, since their careers have gone in such different directions?
That's an interesting question. Well, you know, once we start, I like to rehearse a lot. The average studio film rehearses for 1 week or 2 weeks, and we had 5. And as soon as we were rehearsing a lot, I knew they were going to work as a couple. They're both very good actors. And I think, in a way, except for Woody Allen's movies, Alan hasn't been able to show it recently, and Lily certainly hasn't been able to, except for some broad comedies. I think what's fun about casting older people in new parts is that you can show that these people have a lot to give that they've never done before.
Now, I have to ask you about George Segal, casting him. Again, somebody who hasn't gotten a lot of parts lately.
George, by his own admission, crashed his career in the 80s. He made a bunch of bad movies, and I think he is glad to be working again. And I think he's a very talented guy who is very funny, and I'm glad he's working again. He was in Gus Van Sant's To Die For, and he's Barbra Streisand replaced Dudley Moore with him, which is ironic because I believe Dudley Moore replaced him in Arthur originally. So karma has come full circle for him.
You're not the only, like, younger filmmaker who's reviving the career of older actors.
You know, I got to be honest with you. In an odd way, older actors interest me more than younger actors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I grew up on the movies of the 70s. There were no VCRs, no cable movies. You know, we went to the movies a lot, and we saw the same movie a lot. And they were commercial, but they were very smart. Movies like Shampoo, Chinatown, All the President's Men. And those actors were very smart people. They weren't people who were just devoted to being James Dean and growing goatees and doing lots of drugs and playing in bands. I mean, that's like the only archetype that dominates young actors today, and it's boring to me. And actors like Robert Redford or Dustin Hoffman or Warren Beatty or the people who have been in this film are very interesting to me because they're smart and they have a wide breadth of experience to draw on.
You know, having seen your movie Spanking the Monkey about incest and this movie about birth parents and adoptive parents, I'm thinking, how did you have the courage to become a father yourself?
Oh, it's a great opportunity to do it right. I mean, to me, I get to kind of relive my own childhood by giving my son a lot the kind of attention that I was unable to get because my dad wasn't home most of the time. And You know, he, like a lot of fathers, was working really hard, you know, like a lot of people of that generation who thought that that was the most important thing to do, you know, to support their families.
So you've deluded yourself into thinking that you're doing it right.
A better job? I believe in evolution. I definitely believe in evolution. I think, you know, my father was brought up by a butcher on Broadway, and I think that he had sort of a rough time with that guy, and I think I had a less rough time, and I like to think my son is having a better time.
So, David Russell, do you know what your next film's going to be?
Yeah, I've decided to alternate. I want to do something that has... I want to go to a bigger... When I say alternate, I mean not do another comedy. I want to do a movie that's darker and more serious, and then later do another comedy. And I want to do something in a bigger world that has a social, political subtext. It's a period piece that has a political subtext to it, and it's sort of a thriller.
I'm sure your parents will be very happy to hear that.
The farther I go from the family, right?
Oh, well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, Terry.
David Russell wrote and directed the film Flirting with Disaster. Book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends a new novel after a break. This is Fresh Air. Graham Swift's acclaimed novel Waterland was a multi-generational historical saga set in England's bleak fen country. Swift's latest novel, Last Orders, also moves between past and present as it describes how the memories of World War II have shaped the personalities and destinies of a group of friends, all English war veterans. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Graham Swift's Last Orders is one of those delicate novels that mutates into a collection of clichés the minute a reviewer tries to describe it. Here goes. A group of English World War II veterans who've lived and worked in the same working-class section of London for 50-odd years gathers together to carry out the final wishes of one of their crew who's just died. In his scribbled final testament, Jack Dodds directed that his ashes be scattered in the waves off Margate, a seedy resort town, the Brits' version of Coney Island. During the car ride down, Jack's three buddies and his sullen adult adoptive son ruminate to themselves about their past, their families, and their disappointments. Sounds like middle-brow masterpiece theater material, doesn't it? That's because although Swift's novel is extraordinary, its plot isn't. Instead, the magic of Last Orders almost wholly resides in Swift's style, the way he tells his tale. Structured chiefly as a series of brief monologues that flash back to events near and far, Last Orders fitfully reels us into the lives of Jack and his funeral attendants. There's Ray, a retired insurance clerk with a fondness for long shots at the racetrack, Lenny, a fruit and veg man at the local market, Vic, an undertaker, all small men, as Ray says, who once had a part in big history. Like many others of their generation, these old soldiers aren't temperamentally inclined to share their emotions. Even acknowledging their feelings to themselves is something they do only in short bursts, hence the mini monologues here, surrounded by white borders of silence. Because the men speak in a kind of rat-a-tat Cockney lingo, I'm not even going to attempt to read a passage from Last Orders. I'd probably sound like some awful hybrid of Fran Drescher crossed with the Artful Dodger. Their voices, though, and their black humor view of the world make an indelible impression. When Jack's car dealer's son, Vince, drives up in a used Mercedes for the trip to Margate, Lenny snorts, "Rommel would be pleased." It's a minor moment, but you know from that joke and others like it that the war is still a constant reality in these old men's minds, and that surviving the war in one piece was probably the single most miraculous thing that ever happened to them. As the men motor their way to the sea with detours at pubs, a war monument, and a cathedral, their individual histories become more substantial. We hear about Lenny's thwarted dreams of becoming a professional boxer and the brain-damaged daughter who Jack deserted at birth, and Ray's longtime love for Amy, Jack's widow. And since their shy confessions about themselves and each other emerge haltingly, their impact is intensified. The cathedral that the men stop at, by the way, is Canterbury, and the month they're traveling in is April, the same month that Chaucer's chatty medieval pilgrims took to the road. But unlike the Wife of Bath or the Knight, Swift's secular pilgrims aren't in search of divine forgiveness. They're only looking to arrive at some clarity about their lives and at the sad end of a long, rainy drive to ceremoniously affirm the bond of friendship. Though if you asked Ray or Lenny or Vic what they were up to, they'd probably just say they were out for a ride, searching for a warm pub and a tall whiskey.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Last Orders by Graham Swift. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Marina Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.